When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host Anthony. Aaron's back! We're going to be talking about Jon's fourth POV chapter. This is the famous introduction to our favorite Gary Stu for one George R.R. Martin, that being Samwell Tarly. Steve and I cover the Bear and the Maiden Fair, and I thought that my conversation with Jana Matthews worked well as a bird's eye view. Take a moment to shout us out on social media, rate and review us on iTunes, share this podcast with a friend. We would love your support. Without further ado, here is Boseman Aeron. So Aeron, last time we had you on to talk about Tyrion, we talked about whether or not Tyrion is a Mary Sue for Martin.
Oh, you brought me on for the other Mary Sue chapter.
Well, right? I feel like we almost have to have the same exact conversation about Samwell. Is Samwell a Mary Sue for Martin?
I think it's definitely a Gary Stu, for sure. I think that Tyrion might represent Martin as he wishes he were, you know, where Sam is him as he fears he is, you know? A little craven, a little cowardly, a little plump, a little overly fond of reading and eating tarts instead of, you know, swinging a sword and getting out there and doing stuff.
Well, he also loves music, and I know Martin is a big music aficionado.
Right. Loves to dance, even though he's not, I can see Martin cutting a rug at those Dragon Cons and the Hugo Awards and the Nebula. Yeah, he's definitely the last one to leave the dance floor, sure.
So I don't think that either one is a straight Mary Sue or Gary Stu or whatever, because I think that there has to be some kind of wish fulfillment enacted by the character, whereas Samwell at least seems like he's every bit is every one of Martin's sort of worst characteristics.
Incapable of finishing books.
Yes.
Sam's has got scrolls stacked up. That just, you know, they're like 75% there, but just oof. There's a couple of thorny issues in the middle. He can't get through.
He likes to start new projects. He doesn't like to finish old projects.
Oh shit! He's a Gary Stu of me. Oh my god.
But in addition to that, Samwell is absolutely Samwise Gamgee, too. So can't be, I mean, I can't see a straight one-to-one mapping of Martin and Sam. In the same way, I can't see a straight one-to-one mapping of Martin and Tyrion. I think it's always going to be the case that a lot of times writers will write themselves into many characters.
Yeah.
It just so happens that these two seem to have a lot... of Mary Sue qualities.
It's like Tyrion is the guy, he's the part of you that, like, a week after you had a difficult confrontation, you think of the perfect insult, you know?
Sure.
And Sam is the guy that actually, like, well, you're stupid, you know? He's the, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, so Sam, I mean, at least as we find him at the end of Dance, Samwell is on his way to being a maester. And this brings up a topic that you brought up earlier, and that was, why didn't Sam just become a maester from the beginning?
Yeah, and I think there's an answer in the books, which is that his father beat him at the mere suggestion of a Tarly wearing a chains, and then he chained his boy to essentially a radiator. He black snake moaned him for 3 days to where poor Sam, you know, the chain around his neck was so tight that he could barely breathe. And every time he nodded off, it choked him. And it was a bad experience. So he's like, even after, because this is during the scene where John tells him, hey, I'm going to send you to Old Town and you're going to be Castle Black's new maester. And he freaks the fuck out because he's still like terrified of his father. But like, I don't understand, like, the more I read about the Tarleys, the more it seems like he's just massively insecure, because it's like all about, oh, the Tarleys, great, you know, it's a martial house with lots of great accomplishments in war, and we've got this badass Valyrian blade, and I don't understand why it never occurred to Tarly to just, like, if he's got... Because think about, like, what if he just leaned in to having a son like Sam?
Yeah.
You know? Like, you still got Dickon as the strong right hand. And there's many, many houses that have that kind of, like, you think about the Blackfish and his dumbass brother. You know, you've always, there's it's not necessarily that, like, you know, the one that leads the house is the strongest military commander, strongest sword. It's like, that'd be kind of a cool combo. Like, a smart guy like Sam that's got the... you know, lots of book learning, sitting at the head of Tarly with Dickon to, like, deal with anybody that gets out of line. You know, think about how much more wealthy and politically connected the House Tarly might be if they had someone like Sam as the lord, with Dickon, his strong right hand. And also, like, what, like, Randall? You know, if any lord comes up and be like, your first son's kind of fat, soft, but just punch him in the fucking face. That's that, you know, and like, yeah, you know, there you go. Like, if anyone gives you any guff about your soft son, you just smash him in the face with your mailed fist. Get big strapping Dickon in there to help you out if you need it. And then, like, I don't know. It's a shame.
Okay. I've got a take on this, and it's a little bit highfalutin, but I'll run it past you.
All right.
Okay, so in gender studies, we talk about things along the lines of sort of varying degrees of masculinity. And the ideal of masculinity, which is going to vary from culture to culture, is hegemonic masculinity. And this is your typical, you know, Captain Kirk type of guy. He's smart. He wins battles with words and swords. He's the kind of guy that you would want to be, like, the lord of a great house.
Wears a girdle.
Sure. Wears a big old codpiece. A big old codpiece. And then below hegemonic masculinity are varying degrees of subordinate masculinity. So you don't have to go to, like, the full-on other spectrum where the person is completely feminized. But, for instance, I think an example of probably hegemonic versus subordinate masculinity in our culture would be like the football player who's a quarterback would be example of hegemonic masculinity, you know, athlete, but also a leader of men, you know, smart enough to learn the playbook, all of that business. Then you all have all these wannabe, you know, men's men. How do you say that? Man's men. Who will wear that guy's jersey. They'll sit at home on their couches, and they'll wear a jersey, and on the back it'll say Montana or Brady or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's not someone who's queer in the technical sense of that term. That's just someone who's a little bit less hegemonic than the other guy, right? So in reality, these ideals of, like, the kind of guy who could be like a submarine captain, that's very rare. It's a very rare type of guy. But it is the kind of guy that you need to be the head of a great house. And so I think that someone like Sam, who is pretty sort of low down the pecking order toward subordinate masculinity, that guy is fine as a second or third or fourth son. And maybe in that role, he could be a maester. You know, if he was the second son of House Tarly, fine, go be a maester. But as the alpha male, and that's what you need your eldest son to be. You need, and if you want your house, your great house, to be even greater, you can't have Samwell Tarly be the inheritor. So I think he's fine as a second son, as the first son, as the inheritor. If he's not that ideal of masculinity, he's worthless That's my take on Randall Tarley's weird view of Sam.
I just think it's like not even in Westeros. Like I think Tarly's, you know, his view is not even mainstream within Westeros, because like there's lots of houses like Targaryens. There's at least two maesters I can think of from that line. That, and you know, the idea that the Targaryens are like pushovers in war is not exactly a thing. I just feel like that he there's some kind of underlying base insecurity, because if Sam wears the chain. You know, not only is like a particular type of kind of feather in his cap, but also then Dickon just becomes the first son, and he's the shining thing that he wants. And it seems like there's a lot of just cruelty, the fact that like maybe Tarly doesn't actually think that he's that big of a, you know, he's
well,
doing a lot
maybe
of compensating.
You're right. Maybe what's required for someone like Randall Tarly is both these weird views of masculinity, or I shouldn't say weird, they're normalized, but they are wrong-headed views of masculinity, plus an inferiority complex. So you get those two together and you end up with this horrible father figure.
Yeah. Or like, you know, the other thing is like I've observed in my own relationships that like the thing that drives me crazy about my kid is the things where his weaknesses that he shares with me. Right?
Yeah, of course.
So like I feel like that Randall might have been that soft boy who liked his music and liked his tarts, but his father beat the ever living piss out of him, didn't have a mother that like stood up to him and said, "Hey, you can't do that." And so he's just internalized all that, and just the anger and the rage that comes out that like Sam's able to get away with it. Like, because there was, I think in this chapter, it's the one where they talked that there's like almost a dozen men at arms that came through and tried to do, "Hey, you're going to have you sleep in your mail, boy. That's going to butch you up. And I'm going to, you know, make you dress like a woman and have everybody at court make fun of you. And that's going to butch you up. And you're going to, you know." And it just
soak in goat's blood or whatever it was.
Get the warlocks of which that's another interesting detail from this story. Randall Tarly, these guys who almost made off with three dragons and buffaloed the mother of dragons, they come over here to put some stiffness in Sam's spine, fails, and Randall flogs him. Sends these warlocks home packing. Like,
you know what? I got a little vibe there. Like really conservative parents who send their kids through conversion therapy.
Right.
I was kind of getting a little conversion therapy vibe.
I was going through this, like these warlocks is like, so at this stage in the game, the warlocks don't have much power because dragons have left their world and the magic has left the world, and they're talking about like, "Oh man, you know, all of our powers are diminishing." I wonder if these two warlocks go back over to Essos and they're nursing their sore back hides, and all of a sudden the power starts flowing into the next book and they start planning elaborate blood magic against Randall Tarly. And maybe that's why him and Dickon end up burning 2.5 years later or whatever. Like, it's like, "Oh, yeah, I can't believe you flog us when we got no power. Ah, you know, we got NBA Jam flames coming off of our heads now. Wait until we get a hold of you, son of a bitch."
All right, I'm going to do a short synopsis of this chapter. Here's my synopsis. Jon Snow is training at arms when a new recruit enters. The boy is notably rotund and must be fitted with modified armor. Alistair Thorne sets the new boy against a much more powerful and better trained Halder. Halder makes short work of him, leaving the boy bloodied and crying for mercy. But Thorne commands that the boy be beaten until he can get back onto his feet, something that our portly friend just can't do. John steps in to help, and soon Thorne has divided the group into Team Piggy and Team Get Piggy. John's skill with the sword wins the day, and he learns that the new recruit is Samwell Tarly, eldest son of Randall Tarly. John later learns that Sam has been forced to the wall, fleeing a death threat from his father. It seems that Randall Tarly refused to let a coward become the Lord of Horn Hill. Sam, a self-confessed coward, is an outcast at first, but befriends John. John convinces the rest of the recruits to disobey Thorne and spare Sam from a daily beating. So, Aaron, do you want to talk about a character, plot point, a theme, or shall you and I just climb the ladder of chaos?
I tell you what, before we, I mean, maybe we climb the ladder of chaos, but like I do want to say that I was particularly mortified when I did the stone to pounds calculation to find that I was only about 5 pounds less heavy than the literal fattest person that Jon Snow has ever seen. So that had me put down the Kindle and stare into space for about 5 minutes. Thanks for that, John.
When you sent me that text, I was thinking, yeah, but this is the medieval period. Everyone's probably like 5'3" or something like that.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then I did a little research. Nope.
They
were about normal heights.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, thank God I'm above average height, so I can at least, you know, delude myself that I wouldn't be Alistair Thorne's whipping boy. But yeah, that was like, oh, Jesus. Oh, man, I need to cut back on the whatever I'm doing.
You think about the kinds of people at Winterfell. They're eating turnips out of the hothouse or whatever.
Mm.
You know, they're hunting game. They're eating squirrels and whatnot. The people up at Winterfell are probably not living high on the hog.
Yeah.
So it could be that Jon just hasn't encountered a man of, you know, generous girth.
This is true. This is true. The North does not seem, except for Lord Manderly, famously Lord Too Fat to Sit a Horse, who's a Southron. You know, he's a he's a transplant to recent, only 1,000 years ago, transplant to the North. Yeah, I imagine there's not a lot of girthy people in the North. Or just not the
earlier
food basis for
in
it.
A previous chapter. Tyrion observes that Beaun Marsh, he said he's as round as a red pomegranate. Now, I don't know what that really means, but it's very alliterative, and it suggests that maybe he's rotund. Anyway, Sam's girth is enough to be notable and enough to have to modify the armor, cram him into the new armor.
Did you think that's another one of Sir Alistair's cruelties? Because this guy has a well-fitting and probably very high-quality suit of armor. How hard is it to black armor? And I know leather, you just dye it. Like, there's no, like, I don't think you can get, like, black leather from black cows. I'm pretty sure you have to dye that. So, like, I took this as evidence that this is just, he doesn't want, you know, because, like, Sam, if he's wearing properly fitted armor, might actually look slightly less ridiculous than a guy who's got two pieces of armor that's stitched together with a strip of leather and all that kind of stuff. But I saw that as more evidence of, and I might be wrong. Maybe it's impossible to black metal. You wonder how the chief armor of Castle Black can do it. But like, did you think that was odd too? It's like, this guy's got a suit of armor that fits him and it's high quality. And they're like, nah, you got to put that away. It's not black, kid.
Yeah. I always view Alistair Thorne is something of a drill sergeant who's kind of trying to beat any kind of agenda or willpower, and in this case class, out of a new recruit. Like, if you're gonna really become a brother, we gotta let you know that you're not better than anyone else, especially, you know, if you were the eldest son of a great house or something like that. So I saw that as kind of, I gotta beat the class out of this kid. Or it could just be like, hey, you're nothing, you're gonna wear the same armor as everyone else, and if you're too fat for it, we're gonna shame you into thinning down so that you fit into this armor. I wouldn't put any of that past Thorne.
Yeah, and I can see a certain amount of sense of that like, you know, maybe like, when Sam walks through the gates, they're like, oh, Jesus, this kid's going to be a steward for sure. You know, the idea that he's going to be a ranger, nah. But like, in the 10,000 year plus history of the Night's Watch, right, like they've had to have some tough luck cases.
But I bet you all of those cases, whether you're a steward or whatever, you still got to be initiated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
if you're gonna become
a man of the Night's Watch, you gotta clean the same latrines as everyone else.
And they even make that point with John that like John's got his favorite duties, but like he's got to muck, you know, he's got to muck stable, he's got to gravel the walks, he's got to do, you know, like he likes going out and hunting game for the Lord Commander's table, but like most of the stuff he does is kind of like backbreaking drudgery.
Yeah, that's right.
Jon Snow really shows his quality. I was actually moved by this chapter. I thought the end where, you know, Sam's like, I've never had a friend before. And Jon's like, you still don't. You've got a brother. I thought that, like, that actually kind of got me. Like, mm-hmm. And Jon's just such a fucking bro. He's such a great natural leader. Mm-hmm. Where they did this great scene where, you know, these kid that, like, cause like when Sam confesses to being a coward, a craven, like none of the others, like, Jesus, we've never seen a guy that just comes up like, oh, you know me, I'm a coward.
Yeah. Who would admit to that?
Right. And like, even John, like, is taken aback and is like, God, that's fucking, this is wild. But instead of like just rolling with his presuppositions and surmises, he's like, you know what? I'm going to actually sidle up to this guy and see what his deal is. And if you ever do that, like, I kind of recommend if you deal with it, if you're working or in a relationship with a difficult person, just, yeah, like, just, and sometimes you'll find out their deal is they're just a giant asshole or they're a fucking idiot. But most of the time, once you hear a person out, you're like, oh, that's why you are the way you are. And you're still these ways to contribute. And the way that John did that at a very young age, of course, obviously, Martin is grooming him to be the impressive character that he's going to become. But I just thought, like, John, this is the reason why John became one of my early favorites, because he's just such a good guy.
So here's I'll read this little passage here I thought was telling. So John is kind of doing his chores, and Martin writes, he could think here, and he found himself thinking of Samwell Tarly, and, oddly, of Tyrion Lannister. He wondered what Tyrion would have made of the fat boy. Mm. Most men would rather deny a hard truth than face it, the dwarf had told him, grinning. The world was full of cravens who pretended to be heroes. It took a queer sort of courage to admit cowardice, as Samwell Tarly had. And I thought that was an interesting paragraph that I really hadn't seen before, or I don't remember reading before, because it gives you the sense that John has really learned a lesson from Tyrion, and had he not learned that lesson, mm-hmm. he might have viewed Samwell differently. He may not have befriended Samwell. He's able to see a little bit with a little bit more nuance because of his friendship with Tyrion. And in some ways, Tyrion should be credited for this quality of leadership you're noticing in Jon.
Oh, for sure. And like that leads in that reflection he has, the, you know, boy, there's this guy that admits to being a coward, but Jon knows, you know, being a bastard lord himself, the world's full of cravens who pretend to be heroes. It takes a queer sort of courage to admit the cowardice. Like, and absolutely, you credit that new wrinkle in Jon's brain to Tyrion, for sure.
So here's an interesting thing about Jon. Like, he desperately wants to belong, but he's been an outsider for so long that he's brave enough to go it on his own if he has to. Like, he's got all these friends at the Night's Watch, and you're getting mm-hmm. the sense that all these guys have kind of a quirky but lovable personality as a collective. Like, they're genuinely enjoying each other. You know, you've got these kind of types. Like, you know, you got Gren, who can sing, and Pip, who can, like, mimic voices, and you've got right. Rast, who's kind of an asshole. You know, you've got all these sort of...
he's just a fucking rapist dick.
Yeah, total, you know, I guess high school types or whatever. Mm-hmm. And Jon has a nice reputation among them, mm-hmm. but he's not above kind of going his own way and going and sitting with Sam, taking Sam outside where he knows he could probably have a better conversation with him.
That's such a great part. Yeah. Like, Jon seeing how uncomfortable he was and like, you know what, we got to get you out of here.
And this is the part where I don't think Jon gets enough credit. I think that some people don't think he's strategically minded or something like that and think, well, then he's just as stupid as Ned or something like that. I think Jon has this instinctual ability to befriend and see the best qualities in the people around him. And I think that sometimes gets understated. I think that Jon is a natural leader in that way, and that's not mm-hmm. easy.
Mm-hmm. And also just the, like, how Martin yada yadas through Jon Snow's leadership here of the table of boys, that kind of like, you know, they're all down with the Westeros hegemonic masculinity, and they're like, what's this guy? He's truly a craven, and they're starting to lean into the piggy stuff, and Jon like slams his fist on the table and says, stop! And he says, Jon knew the words to move them. One by one, the rest fell in line. He persuaded some, cajoled others, shamed a few, made threats where threats were required. I thought that was like, you could have taken another five pages to actually show that, but like, you can kind of see Jon do it, right? You know, clasping his hand on someone's shoulder and like, remember when you came here and you're this, that, and I did that. And, we all know that I can beat your ass in the sword yard. And when I also got this 10 ton direwolf if I can get the job done.
Yeah, when Jon gets a bee in his bonnet, he can be resourceful. He can cajole. He can argue with nuance. I mean, I do think we're getting the sense that having to be a master negotiator of class at Winterfell has kind of paid off. Like, he has to. He's learned in his upbringing at Winterfell how to be the ideal second son, in a way. There's this story about Kierkegaard where, and it's probably apocryphal, who knows if it's true or not, but Kierkegaard would say that his father knew that he was the smartest kid in his class, but he wanted to teach Kierkegaard strategy. So he said, I always want your marks to be the third best in the class. So Kierkegaard had to learn all of the content of the class, but he also had to kind of strategically miss out just enough so he was always in third place.
Interesting. And I feel
like, it's kind of weird. Who knows if it's true? But I kind of feel like that's what it's like to be a bastard at Winterfell. It's like, you've got to be good enough, but you have to always be just below Robb Stark in what you do.
Yeah, you can't show up the plowboys and the crofter sons and all that, because they'll resent you for it. You gotta elevate people, not lord yourselves over them.
Yeah, right.
Do you think that deep down this is what Alistair Thorne wanted? Because I don't like, you know, like that he was hoping that that this would weld this kind of cadet unit into a cohesive whole. Or do you think that he's actually mad that nobody will beat the piss out of Sir Piggy?
I think he's mad that no one will beat the piss out of Sir Piggy. I feel like Jeor Mormont needed to choose the right person to beat these recruits into submission. And so Alistair Thorne is a hammer of a man, right?
Right.
And he's like, okay, how am I going to best use this guy when the new recruits come in? If they can survive Alistair Thorne, then they will be men. I think that's his whole job, is to make a man out of these, you know, this hodgepodge group of outcasts. And the only way he knows how to do it is to beat someone like Sam into submission. That's my take anyway.
Yeah, and he might. That's a good point that, like, he has to be good at what he does, because we don't think Jor's a fool, and a pretty good eye for talent and how to use it. And this is the position that he's put Thorne in. So,
yeah, you don't want a man with too much compassion in that role. Otherwise, you're not going to get men of the Night's Watch.
Right.
Got a question for you.
Yeah.
All right. So I was talking with my sister, and I was trying to come up with a character who's both kind of a great fighter and also a great strategic mind. Because it seems like in Martin's world, you're either one or the other or neither. But it's very hard to find both of those things in one character. So I'm wondering, can you think of a Game of Thrones character who's both kind of a strategic genius and also mastered the martial arts as well?
I think the closest you come, but the thing is to your point that no one puts him on the top five swordsmen of Westeros, is Ned Stark. Ned Stark was Robert's number two guy and chief strategist throughout the rebellion. Also, you know, a good enough swordsman to hold his own against, you know, as it gets, 5-3 odds against the Kingsguard, but still, and, you know, kind of, you know, not completely embarrass himself against Jaime Lannister, even though he was, you know, wounded, right? I think that's the one I always think of, that, like, he is not, like, got his sword to S rank, right? But he's an A or a B, and as far as his strategic mind and, you know, because he also, I think he put down a rebellion post Robert's Rebellion. I think that he's the one that jumps to my mind anyway.
Come on, man. Ned's no genius. Come on. Famously, he's not a genius.
All the Stark boys know nothing, but I think that, like, you know, genius, I think that, like I said, you know, he was the battlefield commander for Robert's Rebellion, or for a lot of it, the number two guy.
The guy that I brought up when I was having this conversation with my sister was Bronn. Like, I think Bronn's a killer. A killer who I'd put, you know, hand-to-hand combat with almost anyone, sword-to-sword combat with almost anyone, and I think he's really smart, too. And her point was, is he the kind of smart that kind of can think 5 steps ahead of everyone else, like Tywin or Tyrion or Varys or Littlefinger? And I had to admit, no, I don't think Bronn is that person, and I certainly don't think Ned is that person.
No, like, I think Bronn's like a special forces commander. Like, you know, you give him 40 good men and some rope and he'll impregnate various bitches. But, like, you know, logistics, can you imagine Bronn, like, looking over tables and trying to, like, decide how many slabs of salted pork he needs versus how many barrels of water and ale for the campaign?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, I think that Ned can do that. I think that Ned can do that strategic thinking.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying he's a genius. I'm just saying that he, you know, and leading men and mastering logistics and stuff, that I think that he's one of the better blends of brawn and brain, at least in martial areas. He doesn't know any fuck all about politics, which is a liability in a military commander for sure. But yeah.
So I think that this is kind of an interesting move that Martin does. I don't think he wants any one character to have that kind of power. You know, there's no Darth Vader yet in this world unless, like, someone like Euron becomes that person. You know, even someone like Tywin, who you think probably would acquit himself pretty well in his youth, has, you know, he's dealing with his own age, right?
Yeah,
even someone like Dany, who's pretty smart and has the biggest guns, she doesn't know how to fire those weapons. She doesn't know how to wield her dragons yet.
Right.
So everyone who has, everyone so far in this story has potential to be a Darth Vader type, but no one has fully kind of gotten to that brain plus brawn equals superpower kind of status yet.
Yeah. I go along with that.
Notable introductions in this chapter. We hear about, well, of course, Sam. Sam is introduced.
Because Sam has lead off with the big one, literally.
Yeah, Sam. We meet Albit and someone named Pimple. Would you rather be named Sir Piggy or Pimple?
Is that not Pip? I took that as, like, that was Pip's full name.
Oh, maybe that's what he calls Pip.
No, Pimple... I mean, like that's like Pip versus Pippin in Lord of the Rings. His full name is Pip Pipple.
I don't know. So there is someone nicknamed Pimple, and it's not a great nickname. That's all I know. We hear about Heartsbane for the first time. We hear about Randall Tarly and Dickon of Horn Hill. Dickon of Horn Hill, there's a lot of expectations there.
Yeah, there's expectations for jokes preceding him into the room anyway. Which, yeah, I love how the series eventually pays that off with Bronn. Wasn't it Bronn, like, losing his shit about Dickon?
Well, Jamie does, and then Bronn does. And I think it's the same actor as the guy who was in the Umbrella Academy who plays Dickon.
Yes, he is. He's the gorilla man from the... I just looked it up. Pip is Pipar. So he's this Pimple guy must be something different.
I guess so. We hear about the striding huntsman for the first time. And I think this is the first mention of Corin Halfhand. I'm not positive about that, but you know, I'm sure someone will correct me if I'm wrong on this.
Interesting.
Rast is introduced. Show versus book differences. I felt like this chapter was like a one-for-one mapping onto the show, even down to kind of the lines that Alistair Thorne delivers. It was very hard to find any notable differences.
Yeah, even the threatening Rast with Ghost kind of goes, like, everything just kind of, yeah, this is very much a faithful adaptation.
Yeah, it's interesting to me which scenes they decided to do that with. Clearly Martin's storytelling wins the day on this one.
Yeah, I thought this was a particularly well-written chapter. There's a lot of just like little grace notes, like they talk about Sam, you know, on the way to Castle Black. I'd never seen snow before, and I thought it was beautiful at first, but then I just froze, and I didn't think it would ever end. And then John, when Sam just breaks down and starts weeping, John just sits there and like lets it happen, and he says, like the snowfall on the Barrowlands, it seemed the tears would never end. I thought that was pretty nice.
Okay, Aaron, you're not going to remember this. My very first email to you was an email that I sent to the Bald Move account to ask you this question, this very question.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you've got John, you've got his second, whose name's Sam, and if you put Pippar and Gren together, you basically get Peregrin. And so I wanted to know if the Pip, Gren, Sam, and John combination is something of an analog to the Frodo, Sam, Pippin, and Merry combination.
First of all, Jesus Christ, these last few years is a long way to go to get your answer. Kudos for the long.
You did answer that on the show.
Man, I hope I have the same answer. I think of course, like Martin is very playful in his writing. We know that he throws in New York Giants references to, you know, to quarterbacks, to teams, to all that kind of stuff. Like 1-1 is a big Phil Simms joke, and there's a Dark Lord Belichick. You know what I'm saying? Like, and the idea that he would not do that to the man that he essentially owes everyone that's written about a dungeon, a dragon, or accommodations owes it all to Tolkien.
Right.
So I think that's the idea that he's broken these names and kind of like, you know, you got Pip for, you know, Pippin and Gren for Per. I think that makes a lot of sense. Is that what I said back in the day?
Here's the second part of the question, and I think this is where you demurred. All right. So then the second part of my question was this: if that's the case, then that means John is kind of taking the Frodo role. Are there enough interesting parallels between Frodo and John to be predictive for John's outcome?
Well, I guess, yeah. Now, I mean, like, to the extent that the broad strokes of the television show are eventually what Martin intends, I kind of believe that, like, in fact, a couple months ago, I read someone kind of, like, deconstructing season 8 and, like, Martinifying it. Like, okay, well, maybe this wasn't the greatest way to get to, and who else has a better story than Bran? But like, you know, with a little touch more of darkness and melancholy and bittersweet that you can get to some of these notes. I think it's telling that like John did save the kingdom for everyone but himself. Right. That's what Frodo said. I'm glad I saved the Shire, but I didn't save it for me. And there's some wounds that won't heal. He loses the love of his life and he ends up metaphorically sailing to the west by going back to Castle Black where, yeah, you know, he knows his place and everything fits and he can no longer concern himself with the affairs of the realm and et cetera, et cetera. So like, yeah, I can see that, like, the Jon Snow's cursed. He's not going to have like an Aragorn coronation where he gets his best girl and he's going to have a bunch of kids, and he's made whole by all this stuff. He can just, like, kind of shrug his shoulders, let all that weight fall off of him, and just be Lord, probably the best Lord Commander the Watch has had in several generations.
And if you think about the wall kind of representing the end of the world, it is kind of what Frodo does at the end. You know, he goes beyond the end of the world. He goes beyond the sea to kind of into retirement, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an interesting parallel, and I'm often, you know, really reluctant to find any kind of allegory. You know, I don't think that Martin ever wants a one-to-one mapping. Like, even with sort of the Pippar and Gren naming, that sounds like Peregrin took, but then Merry's left out of it. But then there are four of them together, you know. So it's like Martin never chooses to do a perfect mapping one-to-one. Like, Sam may be a Gary Stu, but he's also Samwise Gamgee. So he's conflating, he's dividing, he's flipping things on their head. That's how he likes to use homages.
Like, there's another good one, because Samwise is famously stout of heart and courageous. He might not be the best fighter. He might be swinging a frying pan, but he's going to fucking swing that frying pan.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
try to save, whereas, you know, Tarly's going to wet himself. But yeah, you're right. And that is an homage within an homage, because we all know that Tolkien hated the idea that any of his works were allegory or straight one-to-one anything.
Sure.
Although I think he doth protest a bit too much on some of that stuff. I could see, like, you know, Martin's a clever enough writer, and he's been working on this enough that, like, you know, if he's got some wheels within wheels, some homages within homages, and I think that's a good idea. And it does seem like he's the type of writer that likes putting that stuff in. And I also wonder, like, you know, we got like dozens of these like little book Easter eggs that we know of and are documented. I wonder how many there are actually. Like, there's got to be at least two or three private jokes that he put in there that no one knows. You know, references to an ex, references to a childhood bully, like, you know, like stuff that, like, you know, and we may never know. He might, you know, take that stuff to his grave. I think that's kind of cool. If I was an author, I'd do shit like that.
Well, it's right. And right now we're just talking about intentionality. I mean, then you come up with hundreds upon hundreds of unintentional homages, things that he has sort of gotten through osmosis over the years, just being a consumer of stories.
Yeah, right.
And then they just kind of bleed out of him without him really knowing that he's doing it. And those might guide the narrative too. But the other thing about Martin is that he does like to subvert narrative. So even if he's sort of borrowing from Lord of the Rings here and there, especially if he's doing it consciously, he's probably eventually going to want to throw you a curveball at the end just to kind of surprise and delight you.
Oh, I think when Aragorn gets beheaded in the first book, I think that's definitely a curveball. Shocked the hell out of me when I got there. Yes,
exactly. Exactly.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And as Steve and I cover The Bear and the Maiden Fair, this is episode 7 of season 3. The writing credit goes to one George R.R. Martin. This is the one where Rob learns that Talisa is pregnant and Arya escapes from the Brotherhood. She gets captured by the Hound. And of course, as the title suggests, both Jaime and Brienne fight a bear. Here is Steve Osborne. Steve, if you were going to choose your own personal sex therapist from among the following options,
all right,
which of the following would meet your needs? I mean, you have to keep in mind, like, this is just for you. This isn't for someone you'd recommend to anyone. All right, so there's a Lady Marjorie, who gives sex advice to Sansa. There's Bronn, who gives sex advice to Tyrion. Or there's Tormund Giantsbane, who gives sex advice to anyone who will listen.
It seems obvious to go with Giantsbane just because I there's like a broader approach, because the difficulty of picking somebody to meet my needs is I only know the needs that I know.
Okay. All right.
So I need someone that might awaken something within.
Oh, all right. You want someone that will sort of guide you into uncharted waters.
Yeah, I'm looking for a sexual docent.
Well, in addition to that, his advice comes with, like, choreography.
Yeah, that's helpful.
For those of us who are visual learners.
Right. You know, I mean, like, yeah, it's the show, don't tell.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. So which one of these shall we talk about first?
Do we get the more uncomfortable out of the way first, or?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
Which made you the most uncomfortable?
Well, I mean, so this is a debate in the house. Like, I'll use the phrase "poor Theon," and Heather's just not having it.
Oh,
she feels
no sympathy for Theon.
None whatsoever. Not interested. And I, because we talked about the complication, and so I tried to relay the notion of complication. She's just like, yeah, it's not really all that complicated.
Here's the one thread through all of Theon's character arcs. So we go from a lot of different sort of levels of Theon, different sort of emotional registers of Theon, but through every single register, he's always annoying.
Yeah. That's true.
Like, even, you know, even when he's being tortured, he's a little bit annoying.
Well, sure. I mean, he doesn't torture well, I guess. I mean, it's an unfortunate circumstance, right? I mean, like, that's where he is now. It's like, be a man when you're getting your skin flayed, will you?
So Theon, jeez. Is it this episode that he loses his junk?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right. So I need to apologize on this front. I'm doing my best not to spoil this show for you, but I do believe in a previous conversation, I spoiled this element of the story.
Yeah, I believe this was a post-debrief debrief. So, yeah, I had mentioned that I had gotten a touch ahead, and then you're like, oh, yeah. So they cut off Theon's junk, and I'm like, well, nope. Not yet, I guess.
But I have that to look forward to.
Yeah.
Yeah, so sorry for spoiling that. I know that, I mean, maybe that's an okay thing to spoil. I'm not sure.
Sure. I mean, it's all
right. Did you tell Heather or did you wait for her?
I waited for her. And she's just like not moved. That's what I think is pretty impressive about it. Like, because I'm just like, ah, man. She's just like, yeah, well, don't kill kids.
Let this be a lesson to you,
yeah,
sir.
And I'm like, well, at what point did, like, I'm all, is this just he could just keep getting this ad nauseum and that's fine? She just, yeah, just not super interested.
No sympathy for Theon.
I think she's just still upset from the because he killed John Wick's dog.
Yeah, that's an annoying move too, you know.
Sure it is.
And don't annoy John Wick.
No, and he it might as well be Theon in John Wick because the way he behaves.
All right, so just so you know, in the books, Theon's junk is not removed, although there's a couple hints that it might be removed.
Oh, interesting.
So, in other words, in order to keep Tyrion's nose... a sacrifice had to be made.
That makes sense.
It's sort of like when Indiana Jones is sort of balancing the idol and the bag of sand.
Right.
They did that with Tyrion's nose and Theon's junk.
Yeah. Good news. You keep the nose, Peter. Hey, could you come in real quick? Could you close the door, Peter? We just want to...
Dinklage, Dinklage came out on top for sure.
So this plot line is becoming... I'll be honest. I feel like I'm like, okay, here we go. What's going to happen to Theon now? And so I feel like there's an element of like, where's this going? Like, to assume it serves sort of a larger purpose, right? Like, is there going to be a point where Rob encounters him? Will he be alive? Will he be dead? What does this do to Rob's? So there's just a lot to this that I know that there's something coming, but then there's just so much torture.
A few thoughts on this. I think that torture should be hard to watch.
Sure.
Right? I do think that, like we talked about before, I think that torture on screen is more effective the less you see.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're definitely not going that route with this.
Right.
So it could be very much overdone. And I think I could probably do with less torture. I can understand why someone would have a problem with the way that Theon's being treated on scene.
Well, it's not even necessarily, I mean, like, okay, the torture there, but then I get to a point like, we've just seen sequence after sequence after sequence of this brutal torture. Great. The hope, there should be a payoff. I mean, because I'm into these other stories, and it's like, if you just had a, even just like a scrawl, like a Star Wars type scrawl, and Theon gets his balls cut off, and you're like, all right, okay, I get it. I mean, in fact, that might even be more like...
The other thing that came to mind was that you're introducing this new character, Ramsay, right? So in addition to asking the question, what is this actually doing for Theon's plot? It's pretty clear by now that you've got this new villain.
Right. And this is a complicated villain if unleashed.
Yeah. So this guy, we're being taught over and over again that this guy is a pretty bad guy.
Yeah.
So, and I always feel like, with any good guy, bad guy story, the narrative is only as good as the villain is compelling. That's my bias. I don't know if it's a hard and fast rule or whatever, but I really like stories with really complex, interesting villains.
Right.
So I think that these...
Do you find Ramsay at this point to be complex or interesting? Because I'm not sure I do.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I do.
Well, not yet. However, I feel like I'm learning more about Ramsay in these scenes and not learning a whole lot more about Theon.
That's fine. I mean, I feel like, you know, maybe we've learned what we need to learn about Theon right now. I mean, we've seen him sort of have this moment of regret, but again, is that regret by virtue of being tortured, or is that regret like genuine regret? Right. I mean, whatever, that's kind of like you could put a pin in that, you know, shifting the, and maybe that's the thing, shifting the attention towards Ramsay and all this, as opposed to the Theon narrative, that we're actually introducing a new narrative potentially. It does change maybe the way I view these scenes.
In addition to all of that, we need to add Theon's junk to the dismemberment count.
Absolutely. And how do we quantify it?
I would think at least three.
I think at least three, right? I mean, that's our assumption, that they didn't just leave one piece.
I think that's even worse.
Wouldn't that be something? Hey, keep this one. But he doesn't do anything. Just a reminder.
I could see Ramsay doing something like that, too.
Yeah. Keeping one as a rabbit's foot.
All right. I want to talk about Tyrion, who is being foisted upon Sansa.
Yeah.
A lot of fans were really annoyed with Shay this episode.
Well, you said that by and large, Shay was not a very popular character.
No, not really.
Interesting.
However, in this rewatch, I have found her to be... Well, let me just put it this way. I think she gives Tyrion some good advice. I think when she says, let's go across the narrow sea, we'll just live, you know, we won't be wealthy, we'll just be, you know, man and wife. I think this is good advice. Yeah. I think Tyrion should take this advice.
Right. Yeah, there is an interest. That's an interesting thing to show. We genuinely believe, at least I do, that he genuinely loves Shay.
Yeah, I think we're supposed to believe that, at least, right?
But there's another thing that he loves probably at least equally, if not maybe just a scotch more, and that's the purpose he's found in the game.
Right. He's the guy who's in love with his career and aspirations.
And and for a guy who's...
He wants to see where his ceiling is.
Right. And for a guy who's felt like he may have had a very low ceiling and feels like maybe he's maybe even outperformed his own expectations, or at least has met the expectations that he secretly had.
Right.
To leave it is to say, well, now what? I got to start over. I'm a scarred imp with essentially no, and that's just it. I got to start from scratch, and my scratch is pretty low.
Now, in his defense, this is a pretty harsh world, and his particular physiology is really helped quite a bit by his reputation and the wealth he has.
Right.
Right. It's really, really hard to be a little person without wealth and reputation. So I would imagine. So I think that he feels like leaving that behind means putting himself in sort of a different kind of peril.
Mm-hmm.
The original title for this episode was Chains. It was just going to be called Chains. And there are a few chains that are important in this episode. Dany is becoming increasingly motivated by, you know, being a breaker of chains.
Sure.
Or whatever.
Okay.
And then immediately after that scene, we go to this scene where Tyrion is offering these golden chains to Shay.
Okay.
Right. And I think that the metaphor kind of hits you over the head, right?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Sort of like, what are you offering me, Tyrion? You're offering me literal golden chains. I'm going to live in a house, and I'm going to basically be your sex slave.
Yeah.
And to sort of drive the point home, he says you could buy a ship with this or something like that. I think he says that. Which is, that is sort of a metaphor for freedom, you know?
Right.
So, Jamie saves Brienne from a bear.
Yeah, sure. Little nod to Anchorman. That was nice.
Oh, I didn't think about Anchorman, but I can see the parallel for sure.
I thought about it the entire time.
You're just waiting for Baxter to jump down and talk to the bear?
Yeah, I figured one of the dire wolves would come down and negotiate.
You know, I know a little something about that scene. So originally when they did Anchorman, they didn't have Baxter come back. And they did a couple test runs with the viewing, and it got very... People did not like the fact that Baxter died.
Oh, I would doubt. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
People were like, you killed the dog. You can't kill the dog. And so that was what motivated the return of Baxter. That was through test audiences.
Yeah, well, I think they made the right choice.
I think so, too. Talk about trope busting. You know, you have the... You know, I think that in these sort of wizards and... you know, swords and warlocks kind of shows, it's normally like the knight saves the princess.
Right.
But because we've already sort of subverted the expectations of the knights and Brianna's sort of already sort of a gender bending, you know, person in her role. You can kind of toss in this little tropey knight saves the pretty girl as kind of a meta commentary. I mean, that's kind of how I read it. That, you know, she's in a pink dress and he, you know, he's going to come and save the day, all that business. But it's kind of with a wink and a nod, like, yeah, I know that this is a little bit, this is a little bit hokey.
Well, yeah, but also maybe necessarily so, because what's our wrestling match with Jamie is we can't trust him. He's, if he's a knight, he's a bad knight.
Yeah.
And so, so we've had these like flirtations of redemption, or at least, you know, whether or not it redeems post incest child murder. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. This probably doesn't redeem anything, but it's certainly an act of altruism, or at least sort of guilt motivated action.
This is the closest thing we've seen to chivalry from him.
Yeah, that's right.
Because we've had hints of it with trying to talk about sapphires. Clearly his relationship with Brienne has sort of changed our perception of him. And this is the moment. This is the moment of action where he's like, no, we're going to turn this whole thing around. I'm going to use whatever leverage I have. And he doesn't have a bunch. His only leverage is, look, the mission is to return me to my father. And I can say whatever I want and he'll believe whatever I say. And so he's willing to, I mean, the Jamie that we were introduced to just keeps on riding to King's Landing.
Yeah.
And so to have this sort of save the maiden, you know, the bear and the maiden fair is the title, right? I mean, she's in this sort of ridiculous dress, as you kind of pointed out. Like, she just doesn't, I think it's got to be intentional that she doesn't match what she's all about. So it does have that feeling of like, oh yeah, now this guy's a knight. Now he's the knight that we see as knights, right? I mean, at least in terms of what the lore has taught us. So yeah, while it feels a little hokey and maybe it's a little wink and a nod, there's actually something kind of effective about it in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. So finally, Joffrey and Tywin. We have not seen these two on the screen together before.
No, it's very clear what Tywin's role is.
All right, I have two questions about this scene. The first is that the first is just a statement. The walk up to the throne, like, Tywin is doing so much with so little, so few lines in this scene. But his physical presence, sort of his nonchalant walk into the throne room, taking his time, and then his pause, and then his ascent up the stairs to the throne.
I watched that scene a couple times, just the ascent. I thought that was just
because
brilliant.
Joffrey's just sitting there like, oh shit.
Yeah, it was great. That walk.
What's he
up
gonna do? He can do anything to me.
Yeah. Well, and then Tywin cast such a shadow. And as he makes his way up, and I love it because it's all about like, do you expect me to walk? And like, he walks so deliberately up the steps.
Like, yes.
Perhaps we could have someone carry you.
So to my second issue here, is Tywin in danger? Because Tyrion kind of had this role as hand before. And now we know that Joffrey felt intimidated by Tyrion and then tried to murder Tyrion.
Right.
So is Tywin now in danger?
And it's not like that Ned worked out as the hand either.
Exactly.
In fact, it was Joffrey who ordered him to be killed.
Yeah, these hands are not, they're not doing so well.
Well, so here's the thing, right? So we had a conversation about Jaime being stuck between patricide and was it regicide? And he chose regicide. And there may have been other factors, right? But he may have already been predisposed to, like, I'm not killing my dad. Like, so that part's maybe more clear to him. So with that, you know, that's where you have this, like, where Tyrion is like the one character that seems to befuddle him is Tywin. So again, daddy issues being the case. But Joffrey's a different sort. Joffrey doesn't play by any rules per se. You know, he may be intimidated by Tywin, but then that may be all the more reason to just, well, just maybe I have to eliminate Tywin. Because his daddy issues are very different than everybody else's daddy issues. Because right. his daddy issues right. are like, is my uncle my daddy?
And it's confusing to be Joffrey. It's a confusing time for a lot of reasons. You know, he's a budding serial killer.
Yes.
You know, he's going through puberty. And he doesn't know who his dad is.
Right.
These are all issues.
And it's not just that. It's just that and there's rumors abound, right? So it's like, he's kind of in a spot where it's like, he'll never, you know, and whether he's fully aware of that or not, he's never going to be not seen as the king with an asterisk.
I think by nature, he's insecure.
Yeah, and it doesn't help when your grandfather is also the hand of the king, and you're the king, so you kind of are supposed to be able to tell him what to do, but there's no question that he's probably wiser than you when it comes to most things. But at the same time, your authority is supposed to rule, and you've been, you get slapped around an awful lot for a king.
Yes, you do.
In fact, you might make the argument that he's been slapped more as a king than he has anything else.
All right, a little subtle note I will point out, and I didn't see this till I watched this last time, but his wardrobe is suggestive. What he's wearing on the throne is this, I don't know what you call it, a robe or a blouse or whatever, but it's got flowers on it.
Interesting, and he was very anti-flower before.
He was very anti-flowers, but then we saw the scene with Margaery getting her claws into him. You know, yeah. To quote Cersei or whatever. And I think that there's this subtle suggestion there that he's all in for Margaery at this point.
Right. And so if she's telling him to soften, he'll soften.
Or, you know, if the way to Joffrey's heart is to sort of play up his sadism, she's going to do that. Right.
This is very necessary. Episode, right? This is one I think that you know, we talk about ones that sort of move the plot along. Like, obviously, every episode of things happen that are fairly dramatic, but some just have that more of a feeling of like, let's get you to the next point because the next point's more important than where we are at this particular moment. I think the Danny scene with they bring the envoy in.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's
Rosdahl Mo Eraz, I guess this is.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good sequence.
Right. Okay. I wanted to ask you about this. We haven't really talked about the sort of visual effects of the show. So I think that this season is 2013.
Okay.
How are you liking the dragons? I mean, this is all CGI. Does it take you out of the narrative? Are you noticing it or appreciating it?
I think I'm pretty forgiving of CGI because of, you know, having gone through all the years, right? So I know I'm not watching something brand new, so I don't necessarily have maybe the same level of expectation for the CGI, but I don't think it's bad. I mean, I think it actually holds up decent. I think I've also come to accept what dragons look like with CGI. You know what I mean? Over the course of the last couple decades, maybe going back to Dragonheart with Sean Connery as the voice.
Sure.
So, you know, Jurassic Park feels fine. Maybe that's, I've just grown accustomed to this is what on-screen dragons are going to look like.
Yeah, I think it's decent.
I think it is decent. I think the sound helps. I think they do a good job with the sound, and the sound mixing, I think, really helps with the visuals.
So, yeah, so this is a good scene where Dany's basically, I mean, Dany's holding court. She's finally got a fair bit of power, but she's also smart. I feel like she's definitely punching above her weight.
Right, I would agree. She's got dragons that are maturing. She's got a big old army and working to continue to add to it and doing it in a very, she's working with one goal, and that's she's looking to get herself to that throne. And those.
Well, all right, let me push back on that one. All right. So the one goal would be toward the throne. I think that's right. However, I think she's also convinced herself that she's this liberator. And just like, so wherever she goes, she's just going to free all the slaves. And it's kind of questionable about whether or not this is actually going to get her what she wants. Not to say that that's not a noble end, but was it Jorah that said, look, you don't need this city.
Right.
You do not need this city. And the offer by this Yunkai guy is basically to say, hey, look, you want to go to Westeros? Here's a ship.
Yeah.
We'll give you lots of gold. You can use it. Leave us alone. But she's motivated by disrespect, right?
Sure.
she doesn't want to be disrespected. I mean, none of us do, but very few of us will go to war over it. And she feels like she's making the world a better place by breaking chains.
Yeah, and I'll push back on that just a touch to complicate it, is that you can say that you're a liberator, and in order to liberate, you have to conquer. So much in the same way that Rob was considered a threat because of all of the battles he won, she's been offered the opportunity to avoid battle. Mm. And I think that there's this element of like, look, I can have both. I can be on the throne as a liberator and a conqueror. And I think that the liberation is the great on paper motivation, right? That's the thing that's gonna help people be loyal and will, because if you're gonna lead, like we've seen this narrative kind of come through a lot where Joffrey's been challenged by both Tyrion and Margaery to keep the people sated.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want an uprising of your own people. So be viewed as a little benevolent. Use benevolence as a tool to get to what you want. And you can continue to conquer the more followers you have. Mm-hmm. So there's something to be said for, look, I can, it's like, you know, when you ever play, of course you have, Super Mario Brothers, right? And you can warp zone your way all the way to the end, but then there's still this feeling of like, I mean, I just sort of skipped a bunch of things. I mean, it's within the rules. I can certainly do it, but how good am I?
Yeah. So remember in episode 8 where they go to the casino planet?
Uh-huh.
See, this is my worry.
Okay.
The whole casino planet narrative, it's such a sidebar. I start to worry.
Well, it was an intentional sidebar. I've defended the casino planet. This is the director's attempt to trope bust within the Star Wars saga. So I mean, what ends up happening is that becomes, of course, maybe more important than the actual narrative, is to upset the expectation. So I think from a bigger picture perspective, the idea was if I can upset all the expectations, then now I have the freedom in the next chapter to do what I want. And once expectations are removed, then now I can create a new journey. And then they said, people don't like it. They want the expectations. And so he was pulled from the next project.
There you go. See, let that be a lesson to you. People like the tropes. I mean, Star Wars is a pretty big success. I think that we could all agree. Do we really need to bust it?
Well,
bust it up?
If the criticism of Force Awakens was that it was just basically almost a complete remake of A New Hope, then you run into the wall. Would you hire me for just to do a remake of Empire Strikes Back?
You know what? I liked the remake. In fact, I would love to see a remake of Empire. Empire is a wonderful movie. It's not like I'm seeing all that much original on the screen these days anyway.
You're over originality.
I am over it. I want to see every new actor in Hollywood. I want them required to play Spider-Man in a movie and then Batman in a movie. I want to see that many Batman movies and that many Spider-Man movies.
No, well, you're going to get it.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
In a chapter we read earlier, Joffrey and Sansa go off on this little sort of first date.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just out in the middle of nowhere. And they come across a little town or whatever. And he just kind of walks in and demands lunch or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, but I'm just wondering, like, is it because he's wearing really expensive clothing? And so a commoner would think, well, that person must be the prince because... And it's not just some commoner claiming to be the prince, because only the prince would wear those clothes.
Sure. I mean, think about it today. So if you are in a restaurant or wherever and a person walks in with a Gucci bag and with designer clothes on, you are automatically going to think, or, you know, drives up in a Mercedes, like you're going to think certain things about that person, that they belong to a certain category, and you might not know what they do, or, but you know that they have money. And so clothes have always been used to signify social status and to communicate wealth. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, now that the whole knockoff brand is such big business, but it's also something that luxury brands actively try to stop, is because it's people who, right, you know, quote unquote, don't belong wearing or having those luxury items masquerade as something that they're not.
Sure.
And so we see that in the Middle Ages as well, where, you know, like there's a, you don't want people who don't belong wearing, you know, the color of scarf or the kind of fur, or, you know, wearing things in a certain way. There's regulations on how you could wear your hair, and you're not part of that category.
We're going to have Jana Matthews on every week to answer a listener question. Of course, in order to make this work, we're going to need your help. Please email to book@baldmove.com. If you have a question for Jana, this can relate to a parallel to a character in Game of Thrones. Does that character have an analog in the medieval world? Or it can relate to customs or lifestyle in the medieval world. So, book@baldmove.com. book@baldmove.com.